This is the Working Drummer Podcast, featuring conversations with ground-level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Albetta, and this week I'm talking with Obed Calvert. Since 2021, he has been in the drum chair for Wynton Marsalis and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, with whom he recently curated and directed a series of concerts celebrating the centennial of the great Max Roach. His New York jazz career spans over two decades and includes jazz legends such as Dave Holland, Kurt Rosenwinkel, the Mingus Big Band, Joshua Redman, and many others. His new album, 150 Million Gold Francs, will be released April 12th and draws heavily on his Haitian heritage. We have tons of Patreon content for you to check out, and you can get access to it all for a buck a month. Matt and I are doing monthly installments of the two of us just catching up about recent guests and whatever else, and our old buddy Matt Iceman will soon be contributing some video content there as well. As always, there are video lessons, transcriptions, and bonus interview content from our former guests. Once again, a donation of $1 a month gets you access to everything at patreon.com/workingdrummer. I had the good fortune to see Obed lead this Max Roach Centennial concert recently, and it was one of the best jazz experiences I've had in recent memory. We unpack that and much more, so here you go. Hope you dig Obed Calvert. This came about is Lydia reached out to me a couple months ago, and you were one of a few names that she sort of threw out there that I would be interested in talking to. Mm-hmm. So you were already on my radar, but then we were in Philly about a month ago, and the band on this show that I'm on got the opportunity to go see the Max Roach tribute thing. And that was the last Sunday we were there. We left Philly the next day. Mm-hmm. So I knew it was, you know, LCJO. I knew it was a Max Roach tribute thing. I assumed sort of that it was going to be Ollie Jackson on drums. Mm. 'Cause he was with LCJO for, you know, so many years. But then you come out and Wynton announces you, and I was like, oh shit, it's Obed. Okay. So now I really got to talk to this guy. and man, I gotta tell you that concert was just so good. And it had been a while since I saw, you know, any sort of jazz concert at that caliber. And it reminded me, just how good, you know, a jazz experience can be at its best, because right. at its worst, it can be torture. Fucking intolerable.
It's torture. It's torture.
But it was just such an artful and mature and accessible performance by everyone on stage. It just really blew me away. So thank you, first of all.
Oh man, I'm happy you enjoyed it. Yeah, that was a good run.
So yeah, talk about this concert that you got to put together. Like, you basically curated a Max Roach tribute concert with mm-hmm. LCJO.
Mm-hmm. So when management approached me about curating the show, first of all, I didn't have that much time. Like, I think they reached out the end of November, early December.
Wow.
Which, you know, doesn't really give me enough time to prepare in terms of well, at least in my standards, arranging tunes. I mean, you were there, so I wanted to make sure I wrote some, wrote a couple of arrangements for Max, and also doing my research in terms of, like, Max has played on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of records,
right?
But not many people focus on his compositions, because he was also an arranger and a composer. Mm-hmm. So I thought it'd be a cool idea to just solely focus on his compositions. And I mean, from the 50s, let's say, till the late 90s, his wide of music is so vast. So, mm-hmm. So it was like, man, there's a lot to prepare and a lot to get ready for in terms of.
And a lot to choose from.
A lot to choose from. Yeah. So I figured, why not take from kind of like each era, mm-hmm. that, took a song from the 50s, 60s, 70s till M Boom, which was the last piece that you heard, the one that I composed, inspired by his piece.
Right.
That whole month was extremely stressful because number one, I've never curated a show.
Yeah.
I've never been, had an opportunity to curate a show. And that's a different type of, it's a different side of my brain that I'm just not accustomed to using, right. Like, you put me on a drum set, that's not an issue. Mm-hmm. But now when you have to you're standing in front of 1,000 people, 1,500 people, basically explaining every song, giving a little history about Mr. Roach, and it's stressful.
yeah. And not to mention the fact that it's for a big band. Like, you're not putting together a trio or a quartet or something. No, this is like 18 people. That
the real deal. So, yeah, it was a lot of stress. But I must say, I learned a lot about myself in terms of how I deal with things under pressure, under circumstances that I'm not quite familiar with, mm-hmm. And it all relates to one another, repetition, like one of my scripts, I would repeat 10 times before I move on to the next, mm-hmm. just to make sure things are articulate, And like I said, it's not something that I'm used to. Mm-hmm. But it definitely opened some doors and actually prepared me for this next chapter in my life where, I have a record coming out.
Yeah.
And to be able to curate every song that, I speak about, or every song I perform, being able to speak articulately, so that it was a lesson. It was a lesson.
Yeah.
And I embraced it.
What did you learn about yourself in terms of having to play that creative director role, like, under stress and under a deadline?
I'm much calmer than most. Calmer, but yet very, very I still have this drive on, If it requires me to sleep 3 hours, 2 hours, I'm getting it done, and make sure it's at a standard where it's acceptable.
Right. Right.
And once again, it's Max Roach. Like, you don't want to half step, he's one of our pioneers of the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't really take that job for granted and bullshit my way around, so I really made sure I did my homework, practiced a lot, getting into a creative space where I can write some music that makes sense and that people would enjoy, mm-hmm. So I learned about myself where under severe pressure, I think I can handle certain things really, really well,
Right, right. And I think you have to sort of, you got to sign up for that, in that in that sort of leadership role? Like you know, because it can manifest different ways, but it, you know, if shit goes sideways, it's going to fall on you.
Yes. Yes.
Right. And that has different consequences. Like, yes. You know, the consequences could be a suboptimal performance, or the consequences mm-hmm. could be you don't sleep, or the consequences could be you take a bath financially so that everybody else can get paid.
There's a price to pay, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Whether it's something, whether it's a positive or a negative. And if it's a positive, like you said, it's lack of sleep. You know, you don't get paid, you know, the rest of the, making sure the rest of the guys are taken care of. In this scenario, that's not really the case.
Right.
Because this organization takes care of us. However, it definitely, the lack of sleep was played a huge role.
Right, right. And talk about the balancing of, like, you know, you mentioned you practiced a lot, mm-hmm. you know, in addition to doing all this arranging, in addition to sort of conceptualizing this concert and being able to, you know, present mm-hmm. to 1,000 people about Max Roach, like, you've also got to sit down and play the drums and feel good about that and sort of, you know, channel Max or represent Max. So how did you go about that?
A ton of listening. So part of my practicing process was a shitload of listening. Mm. You know, during my process of finding which repertoire to play, I learned so much about Max's vocabulary. I learned so much about his phrasing, his and what he didn't play, you know, as yeah. opposed to, you know, he was extremely smart on how he orchestrated bands.
Mm-hmm.
Learned a ton about his orchestration. So that was another form of practicing, to be honest with you. I mean, I spent so much time on an instrument throughout the years where I don't really need to spend 3 hours on the drums.
Right.
But if I go in with a concept, 30 minutes or 45 minutes on each tune is enough, will suffice mm-hmm. for me to really get an understanding on how Max would approach a tune.
Right.
So I wanted to make sure when I did channel Max, it was as if Max, like, I wanted Max to sit across from me and said, wow, he actually checked me out, but he also added his DNA to the music.
Right, right, right.
You know, I met Max once, but we didn't really get to talk about this, but he did strike me as the type of dude or the type of man who would embrace someone doing their homework yet putting their touch on it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not sure. I'm sure he wouldn't want me to sound like him.
Right.
You know what I mean? That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's what he did. And I think that's what all great musicians do is, you know, channel,
Chick Webb,
their heroes and their ancestors
exactly.
and put their own thing on it.
Exactly. Exactly. So that was my approach to it, you know. So when I sat on the instrument, after listening to so much of his playing, I got a general idea of, okay, this is how I'm going to phrase this. This is the space that I'm going to use. This is the dialogue that I'm going to have between my bass drum and my snare, mm-hmm. you know. But yet it will still be Obed. But if someone who didn't know Obed listened to it, they'd be like, oh, wow, this person must have heard some of Max.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally.
So that's how I approached the whole situation.
When you were approached to do this concert, was it like, hey, we want you to lead a thing and you decide what it's going to be? Or what did they very specifically want it about Max already?
So,
like, did you choose Max?
It was definitely about Max. Because, listen, that was the only way I would have said yes. they said, all right, listen, why don't you curate a show, blah, blah, with that amount of time, the limited amount of time that I had, I would have declined the offer.
Yeah.
But because it was Max, I said, no, I got to do this, you know, because I'm not going to let Winton curate a show about Max. What does he know about drums? I mean, he doesn't know anything, but you know what I mean? Like, it's just like me curating a show about Clifford Brown or Miles Davis. You know, it makes no sense. You know, I have to take that role. So Georgina, you know, called me and she said, listen, you know, Winton and I are talking and we're going to put on the show for the centennial of Max Roach. Would you be interested in MDing it? And I, you know, he's like, if you're not, she says, you know, no pressure, you know, he'll do it. But he thought it would be nice if you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Say less. I'm definitely taking on the challenge. So yeah. I'm happy I did, you know?
Yeah. And so that brings me to something else I wanted to talk about, which was just, you know, Winton and his leadership and his mentorship. Mm-hmm. So it seems like, first of all, when did you join LCJO?
I joined officially in 2021. But I had my first gigs were in 2019. Mm-hmm. And we did a tour that ended literally before the shutdown, March of 2020.
Right.
So I did a few shows at Jazz at Lincoln Center, and they had a tour coming up around January, mid-January, that went up to March. It was like a 5 or 6 week tour.
Mm-hmm.
When asked, listen, can you come on the road with us? Or better yet, he asked me if I could join the band. And I said, well, listen, before I make a decision, let's go on the road. Because that's when mm-hmm. you really understand who you're, you know, what the in and outs are, how the organization, how they deal with, you know, the travels, all of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Personalities, it's like 25 people on a bus, you know.
Yeah.
Including copyists and, you know, tour managers, the whole nine. So you want to make sure things are comfortable, you know.
Right.
So I said to him, you know, let's do this tour and see how it goes. In 2 weeks, you may not like me. You may not like what you hear and vice versa. So before I give my final decision, let's try it out. And
yeah.
He says, sure.
Yeah,
and at
cool.
the end of the run, it worked out, you know. And I was
right.
always, I'm still humble in terms of trying to make things easier for what people want in their music. Because in that band, everyone composes. Well, most of the guys compose.
Right.
So Sherman has a way of his approach that he wants me to play. So Winton has a way of his approach. Vincent Gardner, Chris Crenshaw, Carlo. Like, everyone has a different thing that they like from the drums chair. So, like, being able to make those adjustments accordingly, the band kind of dug it. So they mm-hmm. had a conversation, they had a meeting with him. I guess I was aware of this meeting. Come to find out at the end of the tour, he's like, man, listen, the guys really want you to be part of the group. So, and that's when I decided that let's do it. And then COVID happened.
Right. Jesus. Oh my God.
So I wasn't able to officially sign until January 21 because we didn't really have any gigs, you know.
Right, right. So. Well, I like the idea that you just sort of held off on your decision. And it speaks to something that I don't think gets talked about enough, which is that when you're invited to join a band, or, you know, tour with an artist, or you take an audition and you win or whatever, you know, most people in that position are quick to say yes if it's a good opportunity. And I would imagine that you know, LCJO is among the biggest opportunities you've ever been offered, if not the biggest. But what people don't realize or talk about enough is the fact that, like, you're auditioning them too.
Right.
You know, it's not just them signing off on you and saying, yes, we want you.
Right.
You know, there's really something to be said for being just as deliberate with your assessment of them. Not in the sense of, you know, whether or not they deserve the honor of your presence, but if it's a good fit, whether or not it's a good fit.
That's the most important thing for me, you know, like, because energy, spirituality, music is extremely, it's big in my life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't be myself on stage, if I can't be happy, if I can't be free, why? And at that and that stage of my career, I was already playing with Dave Holland, Monte. I was playing with a ton of people, you know.
Well established.
So I didn't really need, I didn't audition for the gig. They asked me to come.
Right, right.
You know, so it wasn't a no-brainer to kind of hold off. I just needed to know whether it would be a great fit. Mm-hmm. You know, because you never know. You never know.
Yeah.
So it was equally as important for me to feel happy. Like life is too short. You know, like I want to enjoy what I do. We're put in a position where we're grateful to do what we love. Why would I put myself in a position where I'm not happy with my job?
Yeah. Right.
You know, so yeah, that was extremely important for me. So that's the main reason why, you know.
Talked about, you know, can I be myself on stage?
Right.
And it's a tricky thing to, you know, match musical personalities in that way, in a way that everybody feels like they truly have the space to be themselves.
Right.
You know, with other types of gigs, or other types of music, you know, there's a job to do. Right. Mm-hmm. You're playing a specific role and, you know, if you're lucky, you get to put your own sort of personality into it. But, a lot of gigs are a much smaller box. Whereas this, it's like, no, I have a personality. I have a voice in jazz and on the drums. And if my voice isn't going to, especially, you know, with Ollie Jackson having played drums in that group for so long, like decades, you know, did you feel any pressure or hesitation in that regard?
No.
Like replacing?
No, because first of all, I knew I wasn't going to sound like him. That's number one.
Right, right.
You know, I was listening to the band way before Ali was in the band when Herlin was there.
Right.
Which was a completely different energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and. Now we got to remember, being in a big band context, you're already kind of in handcuffs as a drummer.
Yes.
You're not really, you don't have as much freedom because my role is different.
Right.
You know? So I had to make sure that with the handcuffs that I already have on me, I could still, and it took, I must be honest, it took some time because Witten's, he's demanding on drummers. You know, it took some time for him to gain that trust in me, like the way I set the band up. It's not going to be the same way that Herlin does it. It's not going to be the same way Ali does it. I feel music a certain type of way. I feel my beat a certain type of way. And once the band, like there have been scenarios where I actually had to play a drum fill beforehand. I'm like, guys, this is what I'm going to play. Just so they can get a sense of what, you know, how my eighth notes expand and compress.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because we all breathe a certain different way as musicians. Mm-hmm. And if you're not used to that dialogue, it might be hard for you to come in on beat one, or it might be hard to, you know what I mean?
Right. And it might change how you hit beat one. Like the feel of the setup is going to change the feel of their hit, their phrase.
Exactly. Exactly. So
sorry, go ahead.
No.
It's true in all bands and in all types of music. I think, you know, the band kind of takes on the personality of the drummer in different ways, especially true in big band.
Big band. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And you talk about handcuffs. Like I totally know what you mean, how, you know, big band drumming like does put some handcuffs on you because your responsibilities are more specific than a small group and the ways, you know, the options you have as far as the different ways to execute those responsibilities are fewer.
Yeah, exactly.
So I totally know what you mean by handcuffs, but, I also sort of, relish the opportunity to exercise that responsibility and to kind of push the band around a little bit.
I agree with you. And I, trust me, listen, I test the boundaries all the time. I test the water all the time, but it makes it at that point, it becomes more like now we're having fun, you know, like,
right.
You know, let's see what we can get away with, you know? Right. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And now it's to that point where if it doesn't work, we laugh it off. Oh, okay, right. Well, I won't be doing that again. But but going back to the handcuff, this band in particular, it's more challenging because we don't play with amplifications. Mm-hmm. There are no monitors. So I have to play with a certain dynamics where you can still hear the bass, but the guy sitting furthest away from me, which is the second tenor, can still hear.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. So in certain rooms, certain phrases won't be as clear as they would in a smaller room. Mm-hmm. How boomy the room is, how much slapback I'm getting from the venues, all of that comes to play. So like if I'm playing in a venue where like it's nothing but like I'm just playing straight quarter notes for setups.
Right.
You know, because now I'm actually, that responsibility is much more severe and much more intense because there's just no room to mess around with.
Right.
Now, if I'm playing in a club setting where everything's super dry, now I can actually kind of go Elvin-ish, you know, like where I'm kind of opening up where things are kind of loose, but still people can hear where the time is.
Right.
So it's challenging, but I enjoy it. I enjoy the challenge, you know.
Yeah. So going back to Winton, you're relatively new in this band. You've been there a couple years, and he sort of throws this opportunity at you with the Max Roach thing. Was that did you perceive that as sort of a test, like Winton
of
was
course. Oh, man, listen, if you know Winton, you know everything's a because with him, he's not just going to give you all of his trust. You have to earn it. Mm-hmm. You know, and at this stage, prior to me curating this show, like he would never have to worry about me, learning material, getting prepared, making sure I know, you know, the form, like he's not worried about that. But now he's like, okay, well, let me see what his penmanship's like. Because he's never heard that in a big band context. Like I've written for SF Jazz Collective, but that's a nonet. You know, it's nothing compared to a big band. Mm-hmm. So he's like, well, let me see how his writing translates into a big band setting. And also let me see how his presentation, you know, and he's had to help me out. I've asked, I'm like, man, listen, well, what do you do in this situation? And he's like, man, this is what you, because he's been doing it for so long and he does it so well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the way he improvises off of scripts. Like sometimes we have shows where we have a teleprompter and half of what's on the teleprompter, he's not even using.
Right, right. And this is an aspect of the show, like you mentioned, it's sort of giving a little bit of history, diving into the music and the personalities in addition to playing.
Playing. Yeah. Completely different level of stress.
Right. Yeah. So Winton is thinking like, you know, you've already gained his trust as a player, right? You show up on time, you know your music, you play well, you take care of the band. That's your role. And now he's saying, okay, let's see, you know, what he can do as a composer, arranger. Let's see what he can do as MC.
His leadership role, because basically, I'm the leader now.
Right.
You know, like if something's not right, guys, we need to work on this section. Like I rehearsed the band. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
I would go back and listen to the rehearsal tapes. And, okay, well, we need to make an adjustment here. Okay, I don't like the way this sounds. Let's omit this section. Mm-hmm. You know. So that's all part of that test. You know.
Yeah.
And I think his level of respect for me went to a different tier after that show, you know?
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. But it's the mark of a great mentor, I think, I got the impression, I mean, obviously, you know, Winton sort of like spoke first. You know, the band came out, everybody mm-hmm. claps, Wynton grabs the mic, says hello. Mm-hmm. And very quickly he was like, this is Obed's joint. So I'm turning it over to him.
Right.
He's your guy. And like Wynton didn't say another word for the rest of the night. So it was, I got the impression that he, has been in this role long enough. Like at this point, he just wants to be on stage with all these musicians that he's assembled. Like he, you know, he doesn't have to talk all the time. Oh. He doesn't have to play all the solos. Mm-hmm. He just wants to sit there and smile and, yep. and listen to yeah. you guys do your thing.
I mean, that's pretty much it. Which is, it's kind of cool. Cause if you go see the band, like, you know, we have people who come to every show. Mm-hmm. Right at Jazz at Rose Hall, it's refreshing to see something different.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, yeah. Oh, okay, I didn't know Dan Nimmer had that in his bag. I didn't know, you know, like so. It's actually a good thing to open it up, you know, for the band to, you know, to kind of spotlight being a spotlight at some point. You know,
right?
He is
right.
Yes, he's our leader, but we've seen that for so long. That it's kind of refreshing to pass. It's like passing the baton along, you know?
Yeah. I can tell he is sort of gradually passing batons yep. everywhere. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, Wynton is like still the reason they show up. They want to hear him play.
Of course.
Like, he's the figurehead of the band.
Who's denying that?
But you know, and I was perfectly happy to, you know, not have Wynton be the center of attention because it's a Max Roach concert. I'm there to see that.
Right.
Like how has he sort of stretched you as a player or challenged you to, you know, expand your voice on the instrument?
Great question. I would say the most important thing that I've taken from the band since I joined was the attention to details and styles. Mm-hmm. Prior to that band, swing is swing to me. Like I'm just gonna play. So if I see swing on the chart, I'm just gonna play a swing rhythm, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you listen to Fletcher Henderson, his swing, the lope of their swing is completely different from Count Basie.
Yeah,
it's almost straight-ish, you know, mm-hmm. but it's still swinging. It's kind of weird. You know, like it's coming from this ragtime thing, but it has a pocket of almost like a boogaloo funky vibe, mm-hmm. but swinging. It's right. It's so weird. And I really didn't pay much attention to that specific detail until he brought it to my attention. And it's funny because the way he articulated didn't make any sense to me. It's like, man, the feeling right, the swinging right, the feeling. And I would go back and listen to it. I'm like, oh. Okay, now I see what he, because I'm actually paying attention to the micro beats
yeah.
of how a drummer swing or how a band feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, okay, now I see. Perfect example, we have this piece that we played by Duke, pretty much straight.
Yeah.
You know, and remember the first time we played it in rehearsal, he's like, that's not it. And I'm like, and then Chris Crantraw sends me a recording of the original. I'm like, ah. So I came back mm-hmm. and played it straight, but with a little bit of lope in there.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's it. That's even the way the drummer feels, like his fills weren't swung. It was, they were straight almost.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like a kind of like Billy Higgins ish.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And you know, so that's one thing that I could say I've taken from him. Maybe two, orchestration, you know, like mm-hmm. being able to find different ways of orchestrating things. I mean, I've always been cool with making a band or a song sound like painting a picture.
Yeah.
You know, like I've always been great at that, depending on like that's something I learned from Dave Holland, because we play these 20-minute tunes, like these songs last.
Right.
So I got to make it interesting in a way where it's not boring. So yeah. Shaping, dynamics, you know, all of that had to come to play.
Yeah.
So I learned a different way of orchestration, you know, speaking. And we'd have conversations about, you know, micro beats, the long beats, you know, like how do you orchestrate a feel or a comping solo, like that creates a shape that doesn't get in the way of the soloist, but yet still pushes the soloist.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's very, very, very difficult to do.
Yeah.
To not play all this shit where it feels like you're, you know, like you're pushing, but how do you push yet still not get in the way?
Right. It's one of the things that can make jazz intolerable is like
it. Exact.
In the wrong hands, which have been my hands sometimes, it can get really loud and really hectic really fast. And I think one of the things that your concert reminded me about was just patience, like how important it is to have patience.
Yeah.
You know, because in jazz, it's you know, we think of it as the ultimate playground. Like I have complete freedom to run around and do whatever. And you do in a sense, but you know, what's the thing? With great freedom comes great responsibility, great power, whatever.
Yeah.
Every time I hear a jazz musician or an ensemble that exercises patience. And restraint before indulging their expression, like that to me is when the best music happens. And your concert was full of that. Like nobody played really loud. Mm-hmm. Nobody played really busy. You know, it had all the solos had a great arc to them. There were moments of intensity. There were moments of chill. Like mm-hmm. it had the full spectrum, but nobody, nobody went out of bounds ever. Aspect of the concert that you mentioned was the fact that Max made at least one trip to Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are of Haitian heritage. You grew up in Miami, right?
I was born in Miami too.
Okay, cool.
Born, raised there. Both, but my first language was Creole because my mom and dad my mom moved here maybe a few months before I was born, so they didn't speak English.
Wow.
You know, so I learned to speak English via television or school.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I know next to nothing about Haitian music, about mm-hmm. Haitian culture in general. And you did a great job of sort of illuminating some of it in the concert. But talk about how that heritage and that music, is part of what you bring to a jazz stage.
Okay, so I'll give you a one small example. We have a couple rhythms that are in 6/8.
Mm-hmm.
One of the rhythms is called Yombalu. It's basically a 6/8 pattern that you, if you hear Afro-Cuban music, in our music, so if you take any of that subdivisions that any of those drums would play in Yombalu in that style, you could apply it in a jazz setting simply because it's in 6.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? It all turns into triplets.
Right.
So one of the rhythms that called Dada on one of the Yombalu drums is that Elvin pattern. So if you just take that alone and apply it to your swinging situation, in a swinging scenario.
Yeah.
It's music. It all fits.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So with me, and I don't do it all. I don't apply it all the time or on every tune because it just, there's got to be a place and time for it. I like to express that vocabulary inside of my comedy. Because it's something unique that you wouldn't necessarily hear from your traditional jazz drummer who grew up in the States.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like Philly Joe wouldn't come that way because it's a different type of phrasing.
Right.
So that's, you know, with those Haitian rhythms, I like to take different elements and kind of like, you know, put them in there once in a while.
Superimpose it on the jazz picture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you got to hear some of that in the tune that I wrote between Max and Tewol.
For sure.
Yeah.
It was all that. Right. It was built around that.
Right.
And that was the one where you had like the whole band playing
percussion.
They all had some percussion going.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was very cool. So you're growing up in Miami. You're surrounded by Haitian culture, but also Miami culture. I want to get to your experience at Manhattan School of Music.
Okay.
But what was the lead up to that like? What are you listening to? What are you playing? What school are you going to? What is your drum life prior to Manhattan School of Music?
Oh man, that's a great question. Prior to Manhattan School of Music, man, I just played at top 40 bands church. Well, yeah. You got to understand, Miami's not really a hub for jazz.
Right.
There isn't. I mean, I think there was one jazz club called the Van Dyke that no longer exists. And there wasn't really traditional jazz. It's the closest thing you get to. But it wasn't like going to Smalls and hearing, you know, Joe Farnsworth and Eric Alexander. Like, it's a completely different ballgame.
Yeah.
Very, very watered down, like Blue Bossa, Autumn Leaves, yeah. You know, like the usual.
The jam session specials.
It's the jam session. Exactly. So I grew up playing a lot of top 40 gigs, church. Occasionally, there was an amazing trumpet player named Melton Mustafa who had a big band. He actually played in Count Basie's band.
He also played with Bobby Watson a lot.
Yes.
Who was,
wow.
Bobby, so Bobby was my mentor in grad school in Kansas City.
Get out of here. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Him and Melton were really, really tight.
Yeah.
Really, really tight. Yeah. So I played in Melton's band.
Cool.
My junior and senior year in high school. So that was the closest thing I came to like playing some jazz.
Yeah.
You know? And I went to a performing arts high school that was really, really at a high level. Like the training that we went through was impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
So I got exposed to like Black Codes, Count Basie, Carnegie Hall Big Band, like the whole nine.
Yeah.
You know? And our instructor, JB Dias, was great with kids.
I know that name.
I think he did the Monk Institute. He was the head of the Monk Institute
for
a minute.
Okay, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. So outside of school, I didn't really play much jazz, but there was a lot of music going on. There's like a lot of Afro-Cuban. I mean, Miami's nothing but Cubans.
Right.
A lot of stuff on the radio that I would listen to, a lot of fusion. But it was pretty much top 40 gigs and, you know, church funk gigs and an occasional straight ahead gig, it's not like New York, you know.
Right.
So by the time I get to Manhattan School of Music, I have a wide range of styles that I just grew up listening to. You know, now I'm here to hone in on my swing.
Right.
You know, and I stopped playing, which was, I regret this till this day, because I stopped playing funk and like, because that's a completely different touch.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't really take that many gigs when it came to pocket gigs.
So what was it that made you turn your path to, you know, to Manhattan School of, well, to New York, to Manhattan School of Music specifically, and into jazz? Because up until then, you're playing all this different stuff.
Right.
Like, what made you say, I'm going this specific direction?
Just the way I felt playing the music.
Mm.
Just the way I felt playing straight ahead, man. It was, It's a feeling that it was, I guess it was the closest thing that came to me going to playing in church. Mm. The closest thing I came to being in a spiritual setting, mm-hmm. you know? And don't get me wrong. I still kept, once in a while I go home and do some gigs and I still kept my chops up a little bit practicing, you know, my funk and my, you know, and years later, you know, I end up getting called to play with Taylor, you know, Taylor mm-hmm. Swift. Right. And that was like, okay, well, I still got a little something in me. but the reason why I declined that, going back to the conversation we had before, like, would I be able to express myself? Like, you spend all this time working on your craft.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm basically sounding like a, like anyone could, I mean, nothing, I'm not dissing pop or, but that's a gig that most people could do.
Right. Right.
You know, just,
and that's a gig that some people that's all they do.
Like, that's all
that's their bag.
That's their bag. Right? Exactly.
That's their shit.
You know, I wanted to be in a situation where, like I said, I'm just free to express myself. I'm free to play. I'm free to, if I hear something on the Anda 3, I can play it without any repercussions.
Right.
so going, you know, Manhattan was easy because I did this program called the Grammy Band my junior and senior year in high school. And that was like the equivalent of the McDonald bands. I'm not sure if you remember those type of all-star bands.
Yeah, kind of. And is it sort of similar to the, like, the Disney University band, one of those things?
I'm not familiar with the Disney University band.
It's like on the West Coast, it's like an all, you know, similar all-star kind of thing.
Okay. So I guess it's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that Grammy band, the Grammy band would take kids from all over the country. And you go to LA and rehearse. Sometimes it'd be host when the Grammys were hosted in New York, you know, like they'll go to New York. But in my case, they were in LA both years.
Mm-hmm.
So you go and you rehearse for a week and a half and you get to play at the Grammy party.
This is already way cooler than the Disney band.
the
Disney band, like they, you know, they bring in some clinicians and mentors and stuff, but they got you out in the fucking park. Like,
oh no. We got the travel and we got the clinicians as well. So
right.
It was a unique situation, but I say all of that to say that the band director was also the jazz chairman at Manhattan School of Music.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's like. And I already wanted to go to New York. So it was either New School, Manhattan School of Music, or Berklee. And the reason why I didn't go to Berklee, because it wasn't New York.
Right.
You know, it's like I want to be in the mecca of the jazz world.
Yeah.
And when I found out I didn't have to come to audition, you know, JD was like, man, listen, don't even worry about it. You got a full ride. Just... Wow. Show up the day of, you know, school. I'm like, man, that's a no-brainer.
yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, so that's how I got to come to make. That's why I made my decision to go to Manhattan School of Music, and they had some really great instructors there too. So, John Riley, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a no-brainer for me, and I'm in the middle of the city, you know.
Right.
It was
right.
Perfect.
So, like, was John Riley your main drum mentor during your time there?
I studied with both John and Justin DiCiocio. So my first,
what was that second name?
Justin DiCiocio. He's also the jazz chairman at Manhattan School of Music.
Okay, cool.
Justin
I'm not
DiCiocio.
Familiar with him.
Man, a lot of guys went through him. Omar Akeem, Greg Hutchinson, mm-hmm. Kenny Washington. Like he taught a lot of heavy hitters.
Yeah.
His thing was Wilcoxon. That book.
Oh, yeah.
You know Charlie Wilcoxon?
Yep.
Where Philly Joe got all his stuff from.
right.
Yeah.
I feel like Wilcoxon is sort of having a renaissance right now. There are a lot of people practicing, posting stuff on socials.
Man, I don't blame them. I don't blame them.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking, I was talking a couple weeks ago with Robert Perkins, who's a great LA drummer.
I know Rob.
US. Yeah, yeah.
He did the Michael Bublé. He played with Michael Bublé
yes.
for a minute. Yeah.
But we were talking about, you know, the various mentors he had at USC. And we were just talking about, you know, the sign I think the sign of a great drum teacher, or really any educator, is like the range of style and expression that you can see in their students.
Mm.
Right. So, and mm-hmm. I think John Riley, you know, definitely falls into that. Like, look at all the people that definition. Come from John Riley.
He's the pent man. That guy's like, he's the only guy I can think of. You can bring in a Vinnie Cagliuta solo and next week he'll have it transcribed and be like, okay, this is what he's doing. From Vinnie to Jack DeJohnette, it didn't really matter. Like, I mean, he's amazing. He's right. amazing.
Yeah. And he has the ability to help each student develop their own voice, whatever yes. that voice is going to be. He's not like, you have to do this, you have to do X, Y, Z. It's like, what do you want to do? Let's find out who the fuck you are and go in that direction.
Yeah, so, you know, just having them as private instructors, I think that was, and don't get me wrong, I studied with, outside of my high school music, I took lessons with other gentlemen like Kenny Washington, Herlin Riley, Lewis Knapp. Like, I wanted to get a taste of everyone.
Everybody's running around New York. Everybody's there.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Daphnis Prieto, like everyone. Ooh, everyone. Daphnis,
Jesus. That.
Yeah, that guy.
That guy is from another planet, man.
Like, I know.
Just cannot compute how he works.
Yeah, he's great. He's great.
So going back to Riley, what were a couple of things that he kicked your ass about, like whether it's, you know, specific drum nuts and bolts stuff or sort of like bigger musical concepts?
Well, you know, it's funny. I can't use kick my ass because John was, it was always like he would bring something to the table that was so cool that you're like, oh, I got to get this by next week. Like, you were excited to work on it, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I guess I could say this, like every year for our juries, we had to transcribe a drum solo,
mm-hmm.
you know, and play it in front of the whole studio. So if he had 10 students, all 10 students, he'd have you write it out and then you had to perform it. So he took everyone's solo, put it in a nice book. I may still have a couple of them downstairs, made a nice booklet. And we sat there and had to perform it while your colleagues read your transcription while you played.
Wow.
So that was kind of cool. That's a challenge, you know?
Yeah.
But his approach, like, he was always like, man, what do you think about this thing? And thing with John too is like, he had a good sense of the direction that you wanted to go in. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know, his first lesson's like, let's play. And then he'll get a gist of, okay, this is where, you know, okay, so you're into hemiolas, you're into like groupings of fives, you're into metric modulations, you're into certain, like, he kind of, you know, was able to depict that from the jump. Mm-hmm. And then he'll just take it from there and just develop your original voice, you know?
Right, right. I really like the idea of what you described, like, you know, 10 different drummers doing 10 different transcriptions for their jury. And so, like, not only do they perform for each other, like, that creates kind of a little bit of a pressure performance situation for everybody.
Of course.
But then, in addition to the work they've done, like, you know, you've done your work to transcribe your solo and perform it, but then you come out of that with 9 other transcriptions.
It's such an amazing, you know, because then if you like someone else's, oh, man, that's kind of cool. And then you work it, you know, whether it's 4 bars, it doesn't have to be the whole solo, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But you could take, you know, 2 bars of the your colleague's transcription and just embellish over that and create something, you know, of your own with it.
Right.
So it was an amazing concept.
I think in every sort of college studio, you know, the everybody's learning from each other.
Right.
But what John did, I think, is a really specific and acute way to like engineer that.
Yes.
And you know, not only, like, he's working with all you guys individually, mm-hmm. and you have your relationship, but he's like deliberately pointing you at each other and saying, like, everybody, check out what he's working on.
Right.
You, check out what he's doing.
Yep.
It's really cool.
It's kind of genius, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It's kind of genius. And I had some bad motherfuckers I went to school with.
Yeah, who was in your class?
Man, listen. So there was a point where it was Henry Cole, Marcus Gilmore, Justin Brown, Lee Pearson. I'm sure I'm missing a few. But there's so many badass drummers there where you, like, I'd leave my room and hear Lee Pearson practicing, and I'm like, I literally turn back around and go back in there. It was such a healthy competition, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that I don't think I would have been the drummer that I am now had I not gone. Because it was just so beautiful to hear so many different types of drummers, you know? Like, you hear Henry working on his shit, you know, and then you hear, you know, Marcus, before Marcus became Marcus.
Right.
You know, like, we get in there and shed together, and I could hear his phrasing, but I'm like, wow, that's kind of unique. And then he turns into this beast.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Isn't it amazing how, like, a person's voice on the instrument, I think, is established pretty early on.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're studying it seriously, like, if you're doing jazz, if you're doing drums and especially jazz, I think what you want to sound like, or at least the kernel of it, is established, like, pretty early on.
Pretty early. Like, even with early Elvin, like he has, there's this record called Dow JJ5, where he's playing with JJ Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could hear he was extremely influenced by Philly Joe, Max, but you could still hear a tinge of Elvin, like the beginning of Elvin. And then he becomes, you know, by the time The Love Supreme comes out, it's full blown out. You know, even there's a Sonny Rollins record live at the Village Vanguard, Monday Night at the Vanguard, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. That's, man, early Elvin.
Yeah.
You know, but he was much crisper, much more vertical as opposed to linear.
Yeah.
You know, but like you said, you can hear the seed being planted before it becomes this huge, you know, tree.
So you've got this record coming out in April.
Uh-huh.
Talk about what is it, who's on it, what's the concept, what possessed you to take that leadership role again?
the main concept behind, well, two different concepts, well, I would say two ideas, right? I just remember I had a conversation with two different drummers, Chris Dave and Kendrick Scott. And so we're talking, you know, like, man, you got to, and by this time, you know, Kendrick's put out maybe three records. Chris is doing his thing. It's like, man, you got to put out your own record. You got to do this, you got to do that. You got to be your own leader. And I'm like, okay, so if I did create an album, what would it sound like?
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I did not want it to sound like was every other record that's out now.
Yeah.
Like, if you go into a jazz catalog within the past, let's say, the next past 10 years,
mm-hmm.
right, I would say there are probably 10 to 15 drummers who aren't on most of those records.
Yep.
10 of the same drummers, whether it's Eric Harlan, Brian Blade, Tame, Marcus Gilmore, Justin Brown. I mean, I'm sure I'm missing a few people, but it's literally 10 guys on everyone's record. Same thing with bass players.
Yeah, I was going to say Ron Carter, Scott Colley.
Same thing with piano players. Same thing with... So at some point, all the records start to sound the same because it's the same guys. You know, like the same guys who are consistent in the studio, same guys who quick to learn material. You know, like the same 10... to 50 guys. I say 50 guys in terms of including all the instruments.
All the instruments, right.
Right? So I said, okay, well, I gotta do something extremely different. It's far left, you know? And the one way to do that is get guys people don't know.
Yep.
So my whole thing was I wanted to create a record with guys I grew up playing music with, how I fell in love with the music, you know. Okay, so are any of these guys even still playing?
Mm-hmm.
So luckily, a few key components, bass, keyboard, we're still playing, and Harold, who's an amazing keyboard player, but he's really popular in the Haitian community. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not really a jazz player. Like, he's an auxiliary keyboard player, great synth sounds. Addy still plays in church, but yet still has a jazz sensibility. So I'm like, okay, this is going to work out fine. And then Godwin, who's blowing up now, amazing saxophonist. I played on two of his records. He was a great fit because he's of Haitian descent and he understands that vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Dennis Sayud is, he's probably the one that I know the least, but I've known him for almost 15 years.
Wow. Okay.
But everyone else I've grew up with.
Right.
You know,
In Miami. Yeah.
Actually, Godwin, it was probably, I didn't really know him that long too, but we've known each other for almost 10 years. But I grew up with Addy and Harold. We went to middle school together. Mm-hmm. Harold and I used to play in church revivals together when we were 7, 8 years old. You
know? Yeah.
So I looked at it from that angle and created music that we were all comfortable speaking that vocabulary, yeah, musically speaking. So that record consists of a ton of Haitian rhythms. It's unique. It's unique, I think. I took it upon myself to take rhythms that you would play in a voodoo ceremony. Hmm. Like Yanvalu is a groove that they play in ceremonies, you know, and orchestrated on the drums, where now it's just me playing. Mm-hmm. Like if you take a compa groove, which is more modern, the more modern style of Haitian music, you have a percussionist playing the gong part. You have the drummer playing the cymbal, and then you have another percussionist playing the conga. So I figured out a way to orchestrate all of those three elements into the drum set.
Right, right.
Just like some like, for example, like El Negro would do, or Daphnis.
Right, right. I was gonna say, like, you're doing with Haitian music what, you know, a bunch of drummers have already done with Afro-Cuban music, with Brazilian music, like.
Right.
Drum set was not part of those kinds of music. Like, it was a percussion section that then got boiled down, you know, by some geniuses to the drum set. So, well, man, good luck with the record. And it was just so great to see you and hear you in Philly with LCJO. I'm going to remember that concert for a long time.
Oh, man, that means a lot.
And thanks for talking, man. Continued success.
Thank you, Zach.
There you go. Thanks again to Obed Calver. You can pre-order his album, 150 Million Gold Francs, at ropeadope.bandcamp.com. Next week, Matt Krause will be talking with Miles Stone, a Texas-based drummer currently touring with Cody Johnson. Hope you check that out. Until then, stay safe, stay sane, play pretty, and thanks for listening. Cheers.